This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. It's a big week for The Takeaway. We're going to be heading to Mexico later to begin a series of conversations highlighting some unexpected truths about our southern neighbor. For one thing, it is a growing economic power that could overtake Brazil sometime in the next decade. Did you know that? Huge, sprawling Mexico City, home of the richest man in the world. Most people know that. It's a city of the past, present, and future all at once. We'll be exploring. And you might not be aware of this, but Mexico is dealing with a southern migration from the United States. Some stories that could surprise you later this week. Well, today we'll take a look at how the complex and sometimes wild U.S.-Mexico border region both drives and impedes the economies of these two American nations. But we begin in Syria, where a surprise face showed up yesterday, unannounced. U.S. Republican Senator John McCain managed to get where relatively few reporters can go, into civil war-ravaged Syria. He crossed the border from Turkey with an escort from the Syrian rebel army, held talks with leaders of the Free Syrian Army. They gave the ranking GOP member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee a wish list of some things McCain is on the record supporting. They want heavy weapons to fight the Syrian regime, a no-fly zone to suppress the air forces of Syrian President Assad, and they want the U.S. and its allies to carry out airstrikes against Syrian government positions and Hezbollah forces. The Obama administration had no comment on the McCain trip. Meanwhile, the Iranian-backed Hezbollah forces based in Lebanon are making the Syrian civil war a more regional conflict, with fighting spilling across the border between Hezbollah, which supports the Syrian regime, and opposition forces. That development may be driving this development.
The European Union has agreed to bring to an end the arms embargo on the Syrian opposition and to maintain other sanctions on Syria, all the other existing sanctions on the Syrian regime. This is the outcome that the United Kingdom wanted.
That's British Foreign Secretary William Hague announcing that new arms could begin flowing to the rebels from the EU just as a peace conference in Geneva struggles to convene next month. Joining us now are Lise Doucette, BBC Chief International Correspondent. Welcome, Lise.
Yes. Hello. Welcome. Hello.
David Spiegel is also with us, Senior Fellow and Director of the Carnegie Council for Ethics in International Affairs. That's their program on U.S. global engagement. David, welcome.
How do you do, John?
So to both of you, and I'll begin with you, Lise, is the EU now basically arming a regional conflict that has enlarged into Lebanon with the Hezbollah fighting on the side of Syrian President Assad?
No, the EU is deeply divided, John, over what to do next. And it was a clever choice of words by Britain's Foreign Secretary, William Hague, in which he said they have decided not to renew the ban. What they actually decided was not to decide, because they couldn't come to an agreement to keep the ban in place. So it simply lapsed. And therefore, the EU left what was a marathon meeting last night. They thought they would have no agreement in the end, but by default, because they couldn't renew the ban, which expires at the end of this week, it means that there is no ban now, and it's up to individual countries. In Britain and France, the two countries which have been pushing for an arming of the opposition, say, no, we're not going to arm them yet. This is intended to be a signal to President Assad that he must come to the negotiating table in June.
David Speedy, Hezbollah would have us believe this is now a regional conflict. How do you see it?
Well, I don't think there's any doubt, John, that that's the what this is morphing into. Obviously, in the north, northwest of Syria, on the Lebanese border, you have basically a Sunni-Shia war between the Shia Hezbollah on the one hand and the Jabhat al-Nusra, the basically the al-Qaeda wannabes who have pledged affiliation to Zawahiri and al-Qaeda. They're very much in a conflict in the northern areas of Syria. So I don't think there's any question that this is now becoming a full-blown sectarian confrontation. It is bringing in all sorts of actors that are both unwelcome and will certainly take the conflict to a new dimension. This is no longer just a Syrian internal conflict between government and opposition.
Lise Doucette, talk about the airstrike demand, actually the more wish list from the opposition forces that was delivered to Republican Senator John McCain. With Hezbollah more involved in the conflict, does a no-fly zone and actual airstrikes carried out against Hezbollah positions, is that of more tactical or strategic significance all of a sudden?
Well, as you know, John, in the United States, John McCain is one of the most outspoken advocates for a significant escalation in the military intervention in Syria. He has for some time called for a no-fly zone, but he is a lone voice. And as you know, President Obama and those around him are not advocating at all. In fact, they haven't even authorized the giving of any military support at all. Nobody in the EU, NATO, and NATO is calling for a no-fly zone. So I think for now, that is on the basis of rhetoric. Even when it comes to, well, let's just look, what are they talking about now? Those who want to arm the rebels say they want a game changer. They want to shift the military balance. The only weapons that can shift the military balance are the kind of shoulder-fired surface-to-air missiles or anti-armor missiles. And those are the very weapons that most Western countries and indeed most of Syria's neighbors don't want to provide because they fear they will end up, as they see it, in the wrong hands, in the already well-financed and well-armed Islamist groups who, of course, could use them for other purposes.
And Lise, I wonder if you could comment on the other sort of tactical significance, the notion that chemical weapons are being used by the Assad regime. The BBC has been shown evidence which appears to corroborate some reports of chemical attacks in the Syrian town of Sarakeb last month. Here's the eyewitness account, apparently, from a man by the name of Mohammed Khatib.
It was a horrible, suffocating smell. You couldn't breathe at all. Your body would become really tired. You'd lose all senses. I couldn't see anything for 3 or 4 days.
How does this evidence stack up as a motivation for a renewed call to basically militarily intervene?
John, almost every week we get more reports that there has been evidence that chemical weapons have been used in limited quantities, both by government forces, and there was even an accusation that they had been used by the rebels as well. You have that quotation from my colleague Ian Pannell. Also, the French authorities today saying that they're looking at samples that were brought out by a reporter for the French newspaper Le Monde. I think many see this quite cynically because, as you know, President Obama talked about a red line, a game changer, again, to use the word, if chemical weapons are used. Everyone now believes that there is enough evidence that chemical weapons have been used, but in, as I said, in a very limited way. The problem in Syria now is that so many red lines have been crossed. At least 80,000 people have been killed. There have been countless massacres. If you want to take the idea of a red line, well, it's a bit of a nonsense because the Syrian conflict right now is the worst of the wars that we've seen in a long time, and the West has not intervened.
That's Lise Doucette, BBC Chief International Correspondent. David Speedy of the Carnegie Council for Ethics and International Affairs. If there is a plausible case that both the opposition and the Assad regime have used chemical weapons, does it take this whole red line business just off the table completely?
John, I agree completely with Lisa. The problem with red lines, you know, is that once they've been drawn, you have to somehow feel you have to impose them. It's a bit like telling a child you do that one more time, and of course, things are often left unsaid. Also, I on the point that there may have been, it was Carlo Del Ponte, the respected Hague International Criminal Court prosecutor, who pointed out there may have been use of chemical weapons by the other side. I don't think it's too fanciful to think that once this red line has been drawn by the administration, maybe under the sense of we have to do something, that once that red line is drawn, that the opposition forces may well just sort of cross it and then point the finger in the other direction precisely to try to bring the West and the United States into the conflict. So this, I think this is a very complicated and fraught situation.
The fog of civil war in this case. David Speedy, where do we stand on the Geneva conference? The Russians have announced that they're going to send defensive missiles to the Syrian regime. The Russians very involved in this conference with this lapsed EU arms embargo. Where does the Geneva conference stand?
Well, the Geneva Conference, of course, is very much in a state of flux. Let's give the Russians a little bit of credit here. If you remember, 18 months ago, the Russians basically had this on the table. that there be a cessation of arms shipments from all sides and end to the violence and try to bring people to the discussion table. That was something that took a while for us. And then, of course, Secretary of State Kerry went to Moscow, met with President Putin. Obviously, the question then is who comes to the table from the other side? The one fear that one hears is that the opposition forces may feel that their divisions, their internal divisions, would be only too obvious if there is a convening of all parties in Geneva. The other thing I would say, John, is that there's this question of what is supposed to come out of this. Kerry in Moscow said basically all options are on the table. Then a few hours later in Jordan, he said that there is no future for Assad in a post-conflict Syria. Well, that may well be the denouement of such a conference if it takes place and if heaven allow it succeeds. But it's hardly a way of bringing the government to the bargaining table to have this precondition. So it's both imminent and up in the air.
David Speedy is Senior Fellow and Director of the Carnegie Council for Ethics and International Affairs Program on U.S. Global Engagement. Lise Doucette, a provocative question for you on the way out. Is it possible that Hezbollah entering this conflict could tip the conflict in favor of Bashar al-Assad? And if so, would that be a humanitarian benefit to bring this conflict to an end, even if it would mean Bashar al-Assad remaining the leader of Syria?
Well, that's a great choice of words, John, a humanitarian effort to try to end the war. Everyone wants to end the war. Everyone says they want to end the war, but neither side can inflict a fatal blow, and that is Syria today.
Do you think Hezbollah can inflict a fatal blow in a league with the Syrian president?
Hezbollah so far is only working in one part of the country. It's not as active in the north, although we do have reports that Iranian Revolutionary Guards are also involved. There are fighters flowing into Syria on all sides in this conflict. So one actor cannot attempt to shift the military balance. All that the actors can do is simply make it worse.
Lise Doucette, BBC Chief International Correspondent. We also spoke with David Speedy, who is a senior fellow at the Carnegie Council for Ethics in International Affairs. The rebuilding and grieving continues in the Oklahoma City area from last week's tornadoes. The president was on the ground there over the weekend visiting Moore, Oklahoma, where he said the devastation was hard to comprehend and the need difficult to calculate.
I know everybody in Congress cares deeply about what's happening, and I'm confident that resources will be forthcoming. We can't just wait till the disaster happens.
What is the federal responsibility in places like Tornado Alley, where disasters can come quickly, more quickly than federal disaster relief? Joining us now, Republican Congressman Tom Cole of the 4th District of Oklahoma. Congressman, welcome.
Hey, great to be with you.
Of course, you know Moore very, very well. How are people feeling this week?
You know, they're actually doing surprisingly well. Obviously, there's a great deal of grief. We're still going through the funeral process, and when you lose 10 children and 24 people overall, that's pretty gut-wrenching, much worse than even the damage. The damage is horrific. It's two schools, the hospital, the post office, dozens of businesses, over 13,000 houses totally destroyed or damaged, so 33,000 people displaced. So that's a lot to deal with, but again, that's not a new thing here, I'm sad to say. We've had multiple tornadoes in the last 15 years, including two F5s, which is what rolled through here. That's the highest category of tornadoes. So, the response on ground is good. People know what to do, and we're fortunate to live in an area that people really do look after friends and neighbors, and we've gotten tremendous help from our surrounding communities, and quite frankly, all across the country. Americans are awfully good about rallying to help other Americans when times are tough.
Does the sense that this is an area where, the risk of tornadoes is high, does that sense become an argument against federal responsibility, that it may be more of a you take the risk by living in Tornado Alley or living in a hurricane zone? Does that become part of the debate on Capitol Hill?
I really don't think so, because, frankly, there's weather events in every part of the country. And, the damage in, for instance, something like Hurricane Sandy, which is multiple states. This is a really bad at the point of impact, but this is 17 miles long and about a mile and a half wide. That doesn't compare in scope to what a hurricane will do in Florida, along the Gulf Coast, or New York, doesn't compare with what an earthquake will do if that ever hits, and it will at some point on the West Coast. So, you know, I think Americans just deal with these sorts of things, and they help one another, and they have an understanding that sooner or later everybody gets their time in the barrel, sadly. And you help your friend, if only out of a sense that someday you may need help in return.
Can Congress keep the question of relief and aid to areas like this out of politics? It seemed as though the Sandy aid discussion, and the Oklahoma delegation was really a part of that, got very politicized last time around.
I think it did get politicized. And just for the record, I voted for Sandy relief and actually argued for it on the floor. I did the part of the debate that's called the rule, which sets the condition for debate, made it very clear that having lived through multiple events like the one we just had and having been a government official during the Oklahoma City bombing, I understand that tragedies occur. And there's a federal responsibility in these situations. So I think some people, you know, with the best of motives, to be frank, there's no question we do have a deficit situation. Now, in the case of Moore, the money's already appropriated. We do set aside every year a certain amount of money for disaster relief. So it's not as if we don't already have enough money appropriated to deal with what we're going to deal with here. Something like Sandy and Katrina are, you know, really unprecedented events. Nobody appropriates $60 or $70 billion to set aside, in case this might happen. So that's when these debates tend to rear their heads. But again, as long as you got a deficit, people are going to be concerned about it. And I'm all for spending money prudently, saving where you can, being responsible, and that we can always do better in that regard. But once a disaster happens, it seems to me you have a responsibility to the people on the ground to help them. And they don't need to hear a big political debate. They need to know that help is on the way. Their fellow Americans who they have helped themselves undoubtedly in the past will now come to their assistance. That's just what countries do, and that's what Americans certainly do for one another.
What's the lesson learned from 1999? And you mentioned the federal bombing in Oklahoma, the bombing of the federal building in Oklahoma City. In a sense, those two are unrelated in terms of lesson learning. But as far as tornadoes are concerned, what do you think was learned in 1999 that helped in 2013? And then going forward, what are the lessons?
Well, I think actually, you know, there is in some areas actually a connection. The first most important thing in one of these events is preparation. That is that people have thought about it. There are disaster drills that your first responders are extremely well trained for catastrophic events, not just, you know, the ordinary, fire or the ordinary crime, but something that's massive in scope. We're pretty good at that here. I think we showed that in 1995. We're probably better today. As horrific as the loss, for instance, of children was, it would have been much greater if those children in those schools had not been well-trained, well-drilled. They knew what to do. Their teachers, their administrators knew what to do. They took them to the areas of maximum safety, and they knew how to protect themselves as best they could in a situation like that. So preparation is always the key. Second, swift response, and that means coordination over a large area. Again, when you have something like this, the local responders, as good as they are, can't do it themselves. So you have to have built relationships and links with the people around you. And that includes, by the way, the federal government, which is never the first responder, but is here pretty quick. You know, within a day, you've got FEMA people on the ground, but they have to have built relations. We've got an extraordinarily good director of civil emergency management. He was our number two in the Oklahoma City bombing. He's been number one for over 15 years. So those kind of things matter a lot. And finally, preparation for the individual. We've had the leading safe room, as it's called, program in the country. That is, we've built more of them per capita than anybody else. We were the first state to have one to try and encourage citizens to prepare their structures. We need to do more of that, honestly. As good as we've been, it's clearly not been enough, and I think that'll be one of the lessons learned this time.
Well, Congressman Tom Cole, thanks so much for being with us.
Been my pleasure. Thank you.
Republican Congressman Tom Cole serves the 4th District of Oklahoma. The Federal Defense Science Board suggests that more than two dozen weapon systems have been breached. Programs critical to U.S. missile defenses and combat aircrafts and ships have been compromised by hackers from China. The Washington Post, which has seen the report, says the hackers may have compromised U.S. weapons systems. With us to discuss what that means is Richard Clark, former White House counterterrorism czar, currently managing partner of Good Harbor, a cybersecurity consultancy. Richard Clark, welcome back.
Yeah, it's good to be with you again.
What does it mean, compromised in the sense that secrets have been learned, or compromised in the sense that the weapon systems don't work?
Well, it could be both. The most likely is that they've learned how we make our weapon systems. That'll make it easier for them to make similar weapon systems. They could also learn vulnerabilities in our design and therefore be able to target our weapons better. A third possibility is that they might be able to implant code into our weapon systems so that they could activate that code in a time of crisis and disable our weapon systems.
Do you think, based on this Washington Post report, that it is all three, or it's one of the three, and we just don't know which because we haven't seen the Science Board report yet?
Well, I don't think the Defense Department knows. They certainly know that the first has happened. China has copied our weapon systems. You can see that in some of their new weapons. Possibly they've learned the vulnerability of those weapons, and even more remotely, they could have put code in. But, you know, it's so hard to find trapdoors in millions and millions of lines of code. There are some automated ways of doing that, but on certain applications, that's very difficult.
Is this sort of the rules of engagement these days that, in a sense, the Pentagon really has to plan for this kind of thing, that this is what superpowers do in watching each other's missile systems focus on the electronic and software dimensions?
John, I think it's relatively new, and I think the Pentagon is coming to grips with it, that someday they might trot their fancy, expensive weapon systems out onto the battlefield, and they won't work because someone will have thrown a kill switch somewhere. But, you know, the Chinese espionage doesn't just extend to the Pentagon. It extends to everything. Every American company, no matter how small, is likely penetrated already by a Chinese automated program that's looking for credit card numbers or looking for designs of private sector products.
Finally, I remember a story back in the 1980s that the Israelis, when they would purchase U.S. advanced fighter jets, found them too electronically sort of overwhelming and would basically pull a lot of the avionics off and put their own systems in, thinking that simplicity was better. Do you think that on some level Pentagon missile systems have become too sort of complex in software and that they're vulnerable as a result?
All Pentagon weapon systems are moving that way. There are airplanes now that cannot fly. They're unstable. They will spin out of control if their software is not running. I think we've passed that barrier. We're into a world where all weapon systems are essentially software.
And it's certainly cheaper to develop a trapdoor line of code than it is an actual weapon countermeasure.
It's certainly cheaper to steal your research and development than to pay for it yourself.
Richard Clark, former White House counterterrorism czar, currently managing partner at Good Harbor, a cybersecurity consultancy. Thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
Now, a belated diploma for someone who graduated into the history books a long time ago. Over the weekend, Olivia Ferguson McQueen finally received a formal diploma from the Charlottesville, Virginia schools for a commencement she couldn't attend in 1959. As a successful plaintiff back then in a lawsuit to desegregate the city's schools, she found herself facing down the Virginia governor who refused to integrate. McQueen would not go back to her all-black school and was barred from the all-white school by the governor, and so finished her high school education doing tutored homework. More than a half century later, she's got a certificate to hang on her wall and a lot of wisdom to boot. Ms. McQueen, congratulations.
Thank you.
Welcome to the show. And do you have a certificate to hang on the wall all of a sudden?
All of a sudden, I do.
Olivia, what do you think you learned during your unique high school education, and what do you think you missed out on?
Well, let's start with missed out. I missed out. I was a senior at the time, and there were only two high school students who were plaintiffs. I was a senior, and I missed out on all of the things that seniors do. You know, I didn't participate in doing the yearbook. I didn't participate. Well, I was invited to the prom, but just being with your friends, discussing your applications to colleges and whether you were accepted or not accepted, because my day was completely reversed compared to my old friends who attended the black high school. And when my friends were home, I was being tutored by two of the teachers who were employed at the black high school. One was an English teacher and one was a math teacher. So it was a lonely time.
And did you want to be a part of the civil rights movement, or was that your idea?
Well, my father was the president of the NAACP, and as I've stated several times now in the last couple of weeks, I don't know that I had much of a choice.
Did he ever say to you something about the sacrifice that you were making, any acknowledgement of it? Did he try to explain to you this was for a higher cause? Did you understand that from him?
Yes, I did. And many years later, he sent me a letter in 1986 for my birthday, and what, which now stays beside my bed in a frame on a table. And what he said was that never in his imagination would he have seen the things that happened in 1986, where Doug Wilder became lieutenant governor of Virginia, and there was a national holiday celebration established in Martin Luther King, and that I had placed a small crack in the rock of segregation.
A small crack in the rock of segregation. That's quite a present from your father.
Yes, it was.
And what do you think he would make of the fact that the president of the United States is African American?
He would sit with his pipe in his hand, and I'm sure he'd have a lot to say about it, but I think it would be a shock to him.
Well, a shock that began with that small crack with you as a plaintiff in Charlottesville, Virginia. Where does this diploma go in your home?
Well, in our rec room, I have a wall that the key from the city that was given to me by the city council and an honorary diploma, they are framed together and it hangs there. So this diploma will go on that wall, as well as the proclamation from the city of Charlottesville, which I also received on Saturday, that the mayor presented it. So they will hang on that wall together.
Well, congratulations, Olivia. And you know what they say about the high school diploma?
What?
If you have one, it's easier to get a job.
Oh, right, at 71 and retired, surely.
Olivia Ferguson McQueen, civil rights pioneer who just received her high school diploma over the weekend from the Charlottesville, Virginia school system. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
So in the world of the 21st century, where we all live, most workplaces perhaps have come to grips with gender equality. Pay inequality persists throughout the U.S. economy between men and women, but hardcore opinions like women are just too emotional to do this work, or being a mom disqualifies you to do that job, these kinds of opinions are rare.
As soon as that baby's lips touch that girl's bosom, forget it. Every single investment idea, every desire to understand what's going to make this go up or going to go down is going to be overwhelmed by the most beautiful experience, which a man will never share, but that emotive connection between that mother and that baby. And I've just seen it happen over and over time. And I'm talking about trading.
If you're a billionaire, you can say anything. That's investor Paul Tudor Jones a few weeks ago talking about why women, in his opinion, can't be Wall Street traders. So we decided to ask a few. Here with me in the studio is Susan Schaefer Solovey, founder and CEO of Pomegranate Capital. Susan, welcome.
Thank you.
How much does the hairs on the back of your neck stand up when you hear Paul Tudor Jones talking.
This is about the fourth time that I've heard this tape and watched this, and it just makes me crazy. I invested with a lot of excellent female hedge fund managers, and many of them were raising children at the time. So his reality is very different than what I experienced in my reality.
Also with us is Jackie Zehner, the first woman trader and youngest woman to be made a partner at Goldman Sachs. Jackie, welcome.
Thank you.
So are you a follower of Paul Tudor Jones's family notions of family life in America in 2013?
No, exactly the opposite. And just like Susan, my personal life experience is completely the opposite. I was a trader. I'm not a macro trader in the context that Paul describes it, but I was required to have those views and trade-offs, market information in much the same way as a macro trader would while still making markets and securities for over a decade at Goldman Sachs, and did so while having children, while being a mother. So when I heard that statement, my hairs on the back of my neck stood out as well, and really called us to action to speak out about that, and not only our personal experiences and those of women managers, but in fact a whole lot of evidence and research that has been done to basically say there's no truth in what he said about mothers' inability to perform. And in fact, the opposite. There's a lot of studies that show that women are exceptional managers. And as the moderator pointed out in the discussion, perhaps are more risk measured. So in my view, it's just a matter of time before women raise to the level of the Paul Tudor Joneses of the world. But they will be held back if views like that are espoused and believed in.
Jackie Zehner is the first woman trader and youngest woman to be made a partner at Goldman Sachs. So with me here in the studio is Susan Schaefer-Solove, founder and CEO of Pomegranate Capital. I wonder, you know, the question of can women perform or not is just absurd on its face because we have evidence all around us. Let's get into the details of what he's talking about here. Is he saying that somehow women can't be detached enough to trade dispassionately in markets where there's billions of dollars at stake, or that somehow having kids distracts you from the numbers on the screen or something, that you're thinking about your baby when you should be thinking about, you know, tin in Kuala Lumpur or something like that?
Yeah, I think what he was saying was that as soon as a woman has a baby, she's unable or incapable of focusing on the markets and following, you know, global macro trading is pretty much 24/7 type of focus. What he said prior to that was that he did feel that women had the ability to be good traders. Where he kind of made the wrong turn was by saying it was once they had babies that they were incapable. My experience and my view is pretty much the opposite. I think that women are more than capable of generating great returns, which is how I ended up starting Pomegranate Capital. It was more of a market inefficiency. Women do get asked potential investors, are you married? What does your husband do? Do you have kids? I even had one manager who told me, she was asked, are you good at math? Because girls usually aren't good at math. So if there is a bias on the investor side, investing with women, it can be much harder for them to start and to establish themselves to grow to be the size of Paul Tudor Jones. But his whole remark saying that they could never be capable of being great managers because of having babies was absolutely wrong.
Let's talk a little bit about the old boys or maybe even young boys network in the hedge fund world. Jackie Zehner at Goldman Sachs, you're in a slightly different situation than Susan here, founder of Pomegranate Capital. But if you wanted to go out on your own and put together enough capital to start a rational hedge fund, how difficult would it be for you to find partners, essentially multi-million dollar partners? Jackie, you first and then Susan.
Sure. I have since left Goldman Sachs, and I'm one of the few traders that have left and actually not started a hedge fund, which is has its own reasons. But yes, there's two sides of that. I have seen women go off and start hedge funds and have no problem raising capital, and I would say that's more of a recent phenomenon. That being said, you know, there is tremendous amount of evidence that we presented in a paper that addressed this issue head on, that women suffer what we call capital punishment, which is by simply the nature of, because they're women, they have a harder time raising capital. And this is true anecdotally. This is also true in the research. And it is much because of these perceptions and biases that people have, unsubstantiated by any kind of evidence, that women are not as good hedge fund managers. It is, and what's truly bizarre about that is that is despite, you know, the financial crisis, despite the world sort of collapsing in 2008, that we still seem to hold on to this. Nick Kristof wrote a very famous op-ed in 2009 saying if Lehman Brothers was Lehman Brothers and Sisters, would we have had the financial crisis? And he cited evidence to say no, because women are, in fact, as the evidence showed, better risk measured. This is not to say that we're arguing that women are better managers. We are arguing that women deserve the opportunity to have access to capital in the same way that men do. And yet, particularly, I think the allocators of capital are much more willing to trust men with money despite exactly the same resumes and portfolios than they are to trust women. And that is what we're out speaking against. It's simply not right and not just in a world where we want, that we wanted to be, which is a meritocracy.
All right. Jackie Zanner, no longer with Goldman Sachs, but was the first woman trader and youngest woman to be made a partner at Goldman. What are your returns, Susan, at Pomegranate last year? Very quickly before we go.
My comment would be that we as investors listen and invest with our eyes and our ears.
All right.
And if our eyes, if we have an inherent bias, it's going to be harder for women to raise capital.
Susan Schaefer-Solovey is founder and CEO of Pomegranate Capital, which only invests with female-led hedge funds. Thanks so much. We're hitting the road today for Points South, Mexico City, home of the richest man in the world, telecom magnate Carlos Slim. Capital city of an economic power possibly rivaling Brazil. Also home to the composer of this music, Silvestre Revueltas. This symphony, not something you might immediately associate with Mexico. Listen. And that's our mission this week, to tell a few stories about the unexpected in Mexico, especially Mexico City, home to more than 21 million people in its metro area. Did you know that? Did you know Mexico has the number one fastest growing tech industry in the hemisphere, number one overall in Latin America? And here's one you might not know. Mexico is number two in the world in obesity. Number one, the U.S., of course. To start us off this week, looking at what is surprising about Mexico, we're joined by Christopher Wilson of the Woodrow Wilson Center's Mexico Institute and author of the just-published The State of the Border Report. Christopher, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
How surprising. I mean, Mexico has experienced some short-term setbacks economically, at least in the last quarter. But the forecasts for growth in Mexico far exceed those of the United States, extending into the next 2-3 years.
Right. In the short term, Mexico is always linked to the United States, sort of the, you know, cold in the United States becomes a flu in Mexico because Mexico depends so much on the United States as its export market. But, you know, what's slowly happened over the past several decades is that the fundamentals, the basis of the Mexican economy has just been improved with macroeconomic stability, a number of factors sort of improving the competitiveness of their manufacturing sector in particular. And that really means that Mexico now is becoming a middle class society and is becoming a manufacturing powerhouse globally.
And is there a tipping point where the dependence on the United States keeps the Mexican industries from becoming competitive worldwide, or do they have something of a crutch in the U.S. market?
Well, competing against, you know, competing for U.S. market is actually has been a really good learning process for Mexican companies. They've become competitive globally because they've had to compete with the global giants that are the U.S. transnational companies. So that competition has been a good thing. But nonetheless, Mexico absolutely does need to get to a point where it's not so dependent on the U.S. for its market. And that will come when Mexico becomes more dependent on its domestic market, when that rising middle class, you know, reaches what you say, a sort of a tipping point, to where its own economy, its own market is driving its economic growth much more than just the United States.
Carlos Slim, worth $73 billion, is he an outlier or is he essentially a model for emerging market wealth and prosperity and entrepreneurship based in Mexico City?
Maybe a bit of both at the same time. You know, he when Telmex, which was the phone company in Mexico, was privatized in the just before NAFTA was implemented in the 90s, he took it over. And so it went from being a state-run monopoly to a less than fully competitive market privately held hands. And so he's benefited from that lack of competition there. But at the same time, he has competed in the United States and throughout Latin America against lots of other phone companies and been very successful. So I think there's no reason to expect that his companies can't compete as Mexico's market becomes more and more competitive. And actually, just within the past few months, Mexico's passed telecommunication reform, which will introduce more competition into its cell and landline phone markets.
We're talking to Christopher Wilson of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, co-author of the State of the Border Report. It's from their Mexico Institute. The border between the U.S. and Mexico is a sort of economic netherworld, a zone of a lot of terrifying phenomena one way or another, whether we're talking about immigration or the drug war. Would you say that the border between the U.S. and Mexico also constitutes the real risk to the Mexican economy, that that's where those risks lie in terms of political instability and the like?
I think that the border region is very misunderstood, both in sort of Washington, D.C. or throughout the United States, but also even in Mexico City. It's an area that's very far from the nation's capitals. And it tends to be characterized in press reports or by analysts as exactly that, an area of tremendous risk. And that's not to say that there's not a fair bit of truth there, but it's also where all of this economic relationship between the United States and Mexico happens. It's where $1 billion of per day of trade cross between the two countries. There are lots of jobs. The northern region of Mexico has been more dynamic economically over the past couple of decades than any other part of the country. So it's an area both of some risks and of tremendous opportunity. On the security front, there's been some really interesting developments where cities that previously were very dangerous, like Tijuana and Ciudad Juarez or Juarez, right across from Texas, El Paso, Texas, have become much safer. Their murder rates have really plummeted over the past year and a half or 2 years. But some of the other parts of the border, especially Tamaulipas, which is the state right across from South Texas, is still facing very serious security challenges. There absolutely are parts of that state where criminal groups exert at least as much control as the federal or state governments do.
One of the interesting things in your State of the Border report, and I'm extrapolating a little bit here, but in a zone, the border area, where there is so much obvious economic cooperation between Mexico and the United States in political terms, as you get closer and closer to the border, you find less and less political cooperation, intelligence sharing and the like between the U.S. and Mexico.
Yeah, in a certain way, there is intelligence sharing, but it happens in a much more informal way at the border. It's personal relationships. So, for example, a group of cops in Tijuana and a group of cops in San Diego actually meet every month just to have lunch and talk. But when they talk, they share intelligence. And when they need to pass some intelligence, they then just have a cell phone number that they call of somebody that they know and trust. Rather than depending on much more formal channels. And so that's one of the challenges for the federal governments is, as we're looking at creating new institutional frameworks for passing intelligence, Mexico is trying to really actually even centralize intelligence sharing even more right now with the new government. How does that fit in a region where intelligence sharing really just means a call or a quick chat between people that know each other? That actually, these cities on the border, Tijuana and San Diego, El Paso and Ciudad Juarez, they're one city. They just happen to have an international border running right in the middle of them. And so the way they function is there's international relations there, but it's of a very different kind than the type of international relations between Washington, D.C. and Mexico City.
All politics, all intelligence, all sort of justice, in a sense, is local in the border region, if you're talking about the U.S.-Mexico border. Christopher Wilson of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars is co-author of the State of the Border Report. Christopher, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And we are headed to Mexico City today, and we will be reporting from there all the rest of the week. We'd love to have your stories of the U.S.-Mexico relationship. If you have one, you can share them at 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can post a comment at thetakeaway.org. We will be in Mexico City taking a look at some surprising stories about a city of 21.5 million people. That's the number that live in the metro area of Mexico City. Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Find us at facebook.com/thetakeaway. Todd Zwillick will be here holding down the fort in New York while you'll be hearing my voice and voices of Mexico City. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.